Even trying to get a handle on the problems of the world in which we live is very difficult, as we saw last time. I was trying to show people that it's almost impossible to understand the crazy quilt problems that confront all of humankind. I understand that when Prince Charles was interviewed by a leading magazine recently, he gave a rather thoughtful answer to the question, what does he think was the greatest problem facing the Western civilized world these days? And he said the food versus population curve. And I found that was profound because very few people are that well informed on the subject. Last time I was showing you that some of the greatest sages and seers of this modern 20th century have said that the only way for we human beings to survive and to expect that our grandchildren are still going to be living in some kind of a world of disequilibrium on into the next century is by the creation, and that very quickly, of some supranational state, some central world governing authority which would have a world president, a world parliament, a world police force, where all nations, as we know them today, with their individual nationalism and sovereignty, their own flag, culture, language, and religion, would be sort of melded into a global agglomeration, and they would just be one world family of people with one governing authority. Now, as I've said the last time, and I knew I couldn't get through it in one program, I hope I do in two, so I hope I can wrap it up this time. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. I can lead you systematically, step by step, right up to the only inevitable conclusion about what the solution really is, as we discover why these men, such as the think tank, the Club of Rome, and past presidents and premiers and historians have told us that the only solution is world governing authority. The only solution is one world government. I can show you why they believe that, why they said it, why it was the only thing they could say. And then I can show you why it won't work, why it is utterly unthinkable, why it is impossible. And at that point, the trough will be there. I will have led you up to the trough. You'll be looking at it. And I wonder whether you will want to take a drink. Because the answer, the only and the inescapable answer I'm going to give you is one that a lot of people find they simply cannot imbibe. And as I said last time, if I were to propose that answer seriously before the United Nations in General Assembly and say, gentlemen, here's the solution for the problems of the world, I think they'd call for the guys in white and they'd take me away kicking and struggling with a big butterfly net around my shoulder. Say, who is this idiot saying things like this? We're trying to get around the business of problems here in this UN General Assembly. He's in here talking about something that belongs to Alice in Wonderland or Pie in the Sky. So you can lead a horse to water, but oftentimes it's very difficult to get him to drink. Now, last time we covered the population explosion. We talked about food versus population curve. There are a couple of things I'd like to add to that as an addendum. Of energy, the diminution of energy supplies, and of raw materials and strategic metals. And the fact that we're growing very, very short in all of these areas, and that these are problems that are confronting us really as a human race. Not any one nation shares these problems uniquely. All the nations of the earth share the problems. Now, we were just talking before coming on the air this time. I was talking with my son, and he was telling me about the fact that recently news has shown that the United States, and just this morning, as a matter of fact, before coming over here to do the program, I noticed on a national newscast a map where they showed me the critical drought areas and the general drought areas all across the United States and where the water tables are going dangerously low and the plight of the farmers that produce about 42% of the vegetables in the United States, which is in the vast San Joaquin Valley of Central California, is enormous. And that as these water tables shrink, and we're in a very critical drought situation in the United States, then the saline content of the subsurface water and the pollution of various salts and so on, it means that the quality of the water they're dredging up is less and less. It means irrigation is more and more. And, of course, all your reservoirs go down and down. And we've even found that permanent crops, such as orchards and the like, you know, 60-year-old walnut orchards, dead as a lack of water in many areas. Well, here we were with 2 years running of bumper crops in the wheat belt of the United States and the corn belt, in spite of some other very severe problems of drought. And then at the same time, the Carter administration signed agreements and promised the Chinese people 9 million metric tons of our grain every year. And now, unless something changes very, very quickly in the spring, it looks like we could slide into another terrible drought cycle in the next summer. And if we do, what are we going to do? We're going to break our word with China? Well, likely the new administration will have to do something like that, and that will bear on what I'm going to talk about as to how it is that the food versus population curve can bring about political consequences, which in turn can bring about warfare between nations as they struggle, as they strive, as they vie and compete for the dwindling means of their survival. So remember my analogy of my plastic overlay, that if I were coming to you as a salesman and I wanted to give you a marketing technique, the first plastic overlay I flipped over on my chart and I pointed to was the big red line of the population explosion that by the early 21st century goes right off the top of the chart. They say the population of the world is going to double. Some say 15 years, some say 40. I say about 35, but that's trying to be conservative, and that is way too soon. Then in another 17 years, then another 9, and then every 6, every 3. This is, you know, unimaginable. We're talking of things that simply are not possible because the world cannot support the population we have right now. Then we flipped over our next plastic overlay, and that was the green line, the so-called revolution in the grain and the foodstuffs that were to be grown in the Philippines and Southeast Asia. And we saw that that didn't work, and that that curve falls off the chart about halfway before you get out the top with a population explosion. We talked about diminution of energy and, of course, the dwindling natural resources, raw materials, and the like. Now, the next major problem, and one that we're really concerned about, especially with the beginning of the Reagan administration and the commitment of about 10% more money to defense spending, the possible deployment of the neutron bomb, the possible reactivation of the strategic bomber program, people worrying about the hawkish attitude of warmongering, about arms sales, a new arms race, what this is going to do in bringing about a confrontation with the Soviet Union. It's going to shipwreck SALT II, and of course SALT II was not necessarily in our favor. And so we're very, very aware of the proliferation and the potential proliferation of nuclear weaponry. Now, already we know the big superpowers of the United States and the Soviet Union and some of the others that have nuclear stockpiles, such as France, Britain, China, India, and other nations that are not quite so widely known, have enough nuclear power to obliterate 50 worlds full of people. Now, people argue, you know, 50 or 35 or 40, but as one person said in England, I think rather dryly, once would be quite enough. And they're quite correct. There was an analogy I've used to help people understand what this means in terms of explosive potential. If every laborer on this earth with a scoop shovel, if every front loader and backhoe, if every great Laterno, huge automotive road working drag, whatever, these scoops that are used to build roads, every shovel in the world and every earth-moving bulldozer in the world could have been laboring from the time of Jesus Christ until today to scrape together a huge mountain of earth. They could not have scraped together a mountain of earth big enough to represent the tonnage of TNT available to these nations to explode in nuclear bombs. Now, does that blow your mind? It's like every one of us easily have available in terms of megatonnage of TNT, that's the way they measure the explosive force. It's like we have available about umpteen sticks of dynamite, like every one of us are walking along with about 4 sticks in our hip pocket and 3 or 4 wired around our middle and a couple sticking out our ears on a short fuse. That's our own private little explosive force just reserved for us to blow us off the face of the map. They say there's enough explosive force buried in that mountain outside of Albuquerque over there, where they have all the security and where a great deal of American nuclear weapons are stockpiled, to blast the whole world to bits. I don't know for sure, but I know about half of our nuclear potential is stored inside the NATO countries, and most of that is in West Germany. And that kind of gives me cause for alarm, too, because of what I know about Bible prophecy and what's going to happen in West Germany eventually. But the proliferation of nuclear weapons is not limited to these nations I've mentioned alone. A book that we reviewed in, I believe, this issue of Watch Magazine that came out last year, and we still have plenty of copies because these are perennially important articles on this article on nuclear nightmare. There was also a book review that revealed that the nation of South Africa had been cooperating with the nation of West Germany, and that likely both of those countries already have the means to explode atomic weapons. We know that Pakistan is likely building the bomb. We know that Israel very likely has the bomb, and I believe that the CIA informed Richard Nixon that the Israelis had the bomb and that they would threaten to use it on Damascus and Cairo if they thought that Tel Aviv or Jerusalem were going to be bombed during that war back in 1973, the Yom Kippur War. Other nations are getting ready to build it, Brazil, other countries. So as we see the potential of utterly irresponsible governments, undependable governments, governments of caprice, governments that can be overthrown and toppled overnight by military coup d'etats, getting their hands on nuclear weapons. As we think, for example, what would it be like if Iran had a nuclear bomb, or Iraq? What would it be like with the implacable hatreds between the two Pakistan countries, or Pakistan and Bangladesh and India, if they all had nuclear weapons? Now, India does. They say they don't have a bomb, but, you know, the thing did blow up. They exploded it, so I call it a bomb. If it explodes, they say, well, it's not a nuclear weapon, it's just an explosive device. Well, that's just so much rhetoric. India does have the nuclear weapons, and of course they have the means to deliver them to nearby enemies. So as you think about 40 nations joining the so-called Atomic Club, and you think about the standoff, the kind of a Mexican standoff between the United States of America and the Soviet Union, that underneath the polar ice cap and up off Murmansk and off Vladivostok in the Yellow Sea and the South China Sea and in the Mediterranean are U.S. submarines prowling around, which this article had to do with on Nuclear Nightmare. And that as they move and as they go to different depths and the yaw and the pitch and the roll of the ship is fed into the computers constantly, then these very super-sensitive guidance mechanisms are continually whirring and clicking away silently, changing the target information in the sensitive warheads, the guidance devices of these huge Poseidon Polaris mechanisms of destruction, so that they're aimed at various population centers or military centers in the Soviet Union. Meantime, off San Francisco and Los Angeles, off Seattle and down in the Gulf and off the Atlantic coast, are Russian submarines prowling along underneath the sea. And they are equipped with nuclear IRBMs that can come crashing down on the major population and military centers of the United States. And the two countries have a kind of a Mexican standoff going. Well, now, what is the danger, and some movies have investigated this and novels, of nuclear war by accident? We have heard oftentimes of accidental triggering of an alarm device where we almost sent B-52 bombers, and that actually happened within recent years. And we hear of some electronic bug somewhere that triggers some alarm that would actually send missiles hurtling toward the Soviet Union. When a Minuteman missile silo blew up in Arkansas, it gave the entire world a case of jitters. When a nuclear bomb was lost off the coast of Spain, it gave the whole world nuclear jitters. Now, as we think of a nuclear submarine captain going berserk and maybe becoming a madman and maybe trying to blackmail a nation by saying, I'm going to send my missiles at you. You know, people have investigated this in Hollywood and written novels and made motion pictures about it. So certainly, when the Club of Rome, as we have our next plastic overlay, telling us what the problems of the world really are, when they assess and appraise the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the potential of those nuclear weapons falling into the hands of people rather less responsible than even the government of the Soviet Union, which I don't think is all that responsible, then we're looking at the potential, as I said, of nuclear nightmare. Now, this is not the current issue. I can't show you the current cover yet, but if you will write for the current number of 20th Century Watch magazine, we have articles in here that have to do with day-to-day Christian living, with your personal finances, with the problems of child-rearing, articles on the existence of God and evolution, articles about the Middle East, about Europe, about the United States, about the economy, articles that have to do in every way with biblical prophecy that show you the march of world news in the light of Bible prophecy. 20th Century Watch will come to you free of charge, no subscription price. We'll give you the first issue absolutely free if you write to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 2530, Tyler, Texas 75710. Or if you want to save the time, just dial area 214-561-2525 and get your free copy of 20th Century Watch magazine. I'd also like to tell you about this booklet, What is the Real Gospel? And you will see by the end of this program and the one to come, as you have seen if you watched the past several weeks, what the gospel has to do with drought, with famine, with natural calamities, with nuclear proliferation, with the food versus population curve, and with global world-ruling government. The message that Jesus Christ of Nazareth brought to this earth has been largely discarded in favor of a message about his person, about his personality, and what a great guy he was. And that is true, that's marvelous, but that's not all there was to it. And this booklet, The Real Gospel, shows you the true overview of what the gospel message is all about. Now, I've got a ton of literature, as they say, I'd like to tell you about briefly. Here's one on the true church. Is it organized? I can send you a very thick booklet, a beautiful booklet about what is the church, what should it do? What about the local church, and what about this television church, the media using television, radio, and so on, the electronic church, as it is called? This little booklet, Are Christians Under the Law? You can have by return mail free of charge. A booklet about repentance. Why should you repent? I've got probably a dozen more that I can tell you about if you want to write for a list of booklets. Here's one about, in a sense, where is God when it hurts? What about natural calamity and tragedy, automobile accident, untoward death of a loved one from an unexpected heart attack? Oh God, where were you when I needed you? And this was written as a direct result of an untoward death of a couple of twin baby boys to answer the heartache of people who can't seem to understand why doesn't God seem to answer sometimes when you're really in desperate straits. This booklet has helped an awful lot of people. This booklet, How to Get Rid of Guilt. Now, I'm only showing you a few of them. You can get a booklet list. And we also have quite an extensive tape program of tape cassettes of full one-hour sermons delivered over the last couple of years on topics by the dozen that you can listen to in the privacy of your own home or as you drive along in your automobile. Many people have these little tape cassettes in their cars. And if you'd like to write for a tape list, we'll send that to you free of charge, no price. If you write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 2530, Tyler, Texas 75710, or dial area 214-561-2525 during normal office hours, or there will be an answering service, even at midnight. You can leave your name and your number, and that way we will get the literature to you in the mail by the next day. You'll save several days' time. Or write to us at that address, and I'll give it to you again at the close of this program. Well, the reason these sages and seers say the only solution for mankind is one central governing authority becomes obvious, doesn't it? Because they know that the individual nations, looking out for themselves with narrow attitudes of nationalism, are simply not going to cooperate. One case in point that I mentioned in passing, if we have promised the communist government of China 9 million metric tons per year, but if we enter another critical shortage, if we have a terrible drought that prolongs any further, and we got a bad one going right now, then very likely the new administration will break the word of the past administration, and we won't send that wheat to these people of China. Then what happens? Well, then you have real delicate problems here, because then you get people very angry at you indeed. Now, let's just use our minds for a moment and ask, what does it require of those of us in the United States, or the people in France, or West Germany, or England, or any other country you want to mention, to become a one-world government, one family unit, instead of being people of the United States, or people of West Germany, or people of the nation of France? Now, what makes a Frenchman a Frenchman? Well, it's his language, it's his flag, it's his background, his history, his culture, his savoir-faire. It is the way he lives his life. You know, when a Frenchman stands out there in the Champs-Élysées in the full sight of the gorgeous monuments of France and hears a band playing the French national anthem, Marchons, Marchons, you know, and a tear comes down his cheek, for pity's sake, we can understand that. We had a wave of nationalism, didn't we? We had a wave of patriotism. For the first time in I don't know how long, millions of American people were saying, hey, I'm proud to be an American again. I'm not ashamed to wave the flag. And as I was doing programs back a few years ago, before our hostages were returned, and we experienced this wave of emotion, we cried with the families, we sat transfixed before our television sets, watching our president be inaugurated, and the hostages coming home on the same day. And it was unbelievable. And yet a few years earlier in the 60s and the early 70s, you could get into a fight by displaying the American flag. You could get into a giant argument about saying the United States of America. People say, what do you mean by that? You know, it's unbelievable. So we can understand, can't we, the Frenchman with a tear in his eye singing Marchons, the national anthem of France. Now, you know, a writer of a leading book on the rise of industry and economy in West Germany, Brian Connells, who wrote Watcher Along the Rhine, was a personal acquaintance of George Adenauer, Konrad Adenauer's son. Konrad Adenauer, the longest chancellor just after the beginning of the post-war period, the Alte, as they called him in West Germany. And he witnessed in a Weinstube somewhere, whatever, along the banks of the Rhine, the following scene. This was probably back in the early 1950s in West Germany. It was a family, the father at the head of the table, the mother over here, and the kids all lined up. They were having a dinner, and they had ordered a bottle of wine. And so the father picked up his Rhine wine, and he gave a toast. And he said, "Here is to the mighty Rhine River, and to good Rhine wine, and to Deutschland." And they all solemnly drank from their glass of wine. And the writer of that book said, "Can you imagine ever seeing an American family at a cafe along the banks of the muddy Mississippi? And here's the father, and he takes a glass of maybe old Mississippi Stump Blaster or whatever, and he says to his family, 'Here's to the muddy Mississippi, and here's to good old Mississippi corn pone,' or whatever." But no, you just can't. You know, we do not express it that way in our country. Now, traditionally, when you go to a social club or a civic club or some public meeting, we have the salute to the flag, the pledge of allegiance to the flag. And we have the national anthem at football and basketball games. And it always used to irk me. I'd go to some of these public affairs and I would see people, even some of the athletes, kind of shifting from one foot to the other, looking around, scratching or something. A lot of people, and I have been to many such events, in huge big sports palladiums and pavilions and so on, where they wouldn't even get to their feet for the national anthem a few years back. So we have had a decided wane of patriotism. Now we've experienced a new wave of patriotism as a result of our outrage over the holding of our hostages by Iran. But what makes a German, and a Frenchman, and the imperturbable Briton an Englishman? Well, it's our language, our tradition, our history, our culture. It is oftentimes mixed in with religion because some nations have a state religion, like the Anglican Church, for example, or the Dutch Reformed Church, for example, or the Catholics of Bavaria. And we Americans basically tend to be Protestant, and that is our mood and our attitude. So now, if one world government, one world family, a homogeneous mass, an amalgamation of Iranians and Iraqis and Britons and Frenchmen and Germans and Dutchmen and Americans, is the only solution for world problems, or else we have had it and we're not going to survive and our grandkids won't have a world in which to grow up happy, healthy, and wise, then is that one world government possible? Is it even thinkable? And since it really isn't, why did these sages and these prognosticators tell us that it's our only way out? Now, why do I say it isn't possible? First, let's deal with nationalism. Call it sovereignty, if you will. What is the sovereignty of every individual state? Some of the biggest issues in geopolitics these days are the alleged interventions and interferences of one nation into the sovereign territory of another nation. That was the biggest issue of these screaming Iranian mobs. They accused the United States of mucking about, messing around inside the internal affairs of the Iranian country, of deliberately sending money or whatever, supporting the Shah, working through the CIA, of trying to keep and to perpetuate a despot, a dictator in office. The same charges come out of El Salvador. They come out of all the other banana republics. They come out of nations in the Southeast Asian periphery, out of Central and South America, and even Europe. Now, every nation, to one degree or another, does that. Every nation, to one degree or another, especially the large nations and the so-called developed countries of the Western industrial world, maintain large intelligence organizations. The Soviet Union have their spies inside our country. We've got ours inside their country. The British have their spies every place, and other people have spies in England. The Germans have got their spies out, and the Japanese do, and the Chinese do. They're easy to recognize. They all look alike. No, never mind. Anyway, everybody spies on everybody else. And to some degree, yes, it is true that embassy officials do carry out
duplicate roles, and this is very well known. And when they're discovered, like the famous bug in the eagle in the embassy over there in the Soviet Union, where the Soviets were listening in the American embassy in Moscow, and this was displayed before the world body, the United Nations, and so on, this is known. When it is discovered, nearly always they simply declare these people persona non grata, and they're asked to leave the country post haste or forthwith. They don't go beat down the door and take them hostage. But sovereignty, everything that makes us who and what we are, that gives us our feeling of patriotism, that gives us our feeling of Americanism, is a deep-seated cultural barrier to the idea of simply melding into a global community of nations. Now, I see next time I've probably left one of the most important things for the last program, and I do want to go into it very thoroughly, because tribalism, racism, religion, language, and especially how would a world-governing president be elected? Who would he be? Where would he come from? How about Bonnie Sauter? How would you like him? How about the Ayatollah Khomeini? Wouldn't he make a great world president? But then on the other hand, do you think the Iranians would like Reagan? So next time I will show you why I say you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, and show you what the real solution, the one which escapes most people, the one which these past presidents and premiers and prime ministers simply couldn't conceive of, and the one which would dissolve the entire UN General Assembly into derisive snorts of ridicule and laughter if I were to propose it were so. But write for 20th Century Watch and get this book on the real gospel. Write to me, Garnett Armstrong, Box 2530, Tyler, Texas, 75710, and we'll send it to you just as quickly as we get your request. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.